Hello, my friends. Thank you for joining me today as I veer off the wine road and onto other paths that still have a handcrafted theme, a distiller, and an author. Let's get this venture started.
You know, at home I was making, you know, 5-10 gallon batches of beer, and now every day I make 1,500 gallons of beer, and then we, of course, distill that into whiskeys. But it's been a lot of fun.
You know what? If you have something that you really want to do and it's out of the box or you think it's impossible, it's never too late to try. If you have that undying passion, I just say go for it.
Ah, I love inspiring comments like that. People of all walks of life have adopted that positive assertion to just power ahead, regardless of setbacks or adversity. Neither of which kept Paula Moulton off her course to become a wine grape grower, an accomplished chef, and author. And as she suggests, even you could do it in the right scenario. We'll hear Paula's story later in the podcast. In the small town of Grayton, California, head distiller Jeff Duckhorn is crafting Redwood Empire Whiskey. They've been around for a few years, but have gone through a transformation recently. It's made and bottled at Purple Wines and Spirits. It's a large facility, but not open to the public, although Jeff toured me through the many areas in which he works, some of which we'll talk about. You might be familiar with Redwood Empire, but they've rebranded and released two more whiskeys. Jeff will take us through the new names and styles right off the bat.
Yeah, so first off, we have Pipe Dream Bourbon, and that's a bourbon that's a blend of bourbons that are ages 4 to 12 years old. It's bourbons that we've distilled in-house here in Grayton at our facility, along with bourbons that we've been outsourcing from other states as well, including Indiana, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
That gives you the opportunity to get it out quicker because you're purchasing bourbon that's been aged a little bit.
Correct, yeah. I mean, it allows us to let our beautiful whiskeys age longer, not try to push them out before their time, and come out with a product to market quicker, as you say, that's more complex and something that's going to be more pleasing for the consumers.
Tell me about your rye.
So the rye is kind of my sweet spot, I got to say. I've always gravitated to spicy flavors and big flavors and bold flavors, and I think, you know, rye really does that for me, and so it excites me quite a bit. But so the rye is a blend of again, sourced and grain-to-glass rye, aged 3 to 5 years. The rye that we're distilling in-house, we've been playing around with some different mash bills, adding some additional malts to the mash bills. So getting some fun flavors, you know, you would see normally in a beer from, you know, chocolate malts and Vienna malts and Munichs and some kind of your darker malts. And so the rye is going to give you a nice big pop of spice like you're accustomed to on a rye, but then it's got some lingering chocolate notes on it as well that I think add some fun complexity to it.
It's nice that you have the flexibility to only have 51% of the rye, and then you can add whatever you want after that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it does. It's a little bit daunting as a distiller because you have to make a lot of decisions up front with these mash bills, but you do have a lot of flexibility on what you do. So as long as you stay in that 51% of your base grain, if you want to make a rye, it's got to be 51% rye. It does afford you a lot of flexibility to play around with that additional 49%. And so we do a lot of that at the distillery, and it's really is fun and exciting.
And you're taking advantage of that, and I got to taste some of those, the advantages of the different flavors and that you're adding with the malts and such.
That's correct. I mean, you know, we are a winery at heart. I mean, that's where this all started. Our owner has been in the wine business for many years, and so we do take a bit of a winemaker's approach to that. And I've always personally felt that blending is really where it's at and where you can really create some amazing flavors and products and just get some nuances. And so we take the opportunity to do that wherever we can. And so I envision that these different mash bills will just give us that much more material to blend with later on.
And tell me about your Lost Monarch, which was your initial whiskey.
That's correct. So the Lost Monarch started out as our American whiskey, and now we've repackaged that and relabeled that as a blend of straight whiskeys, and it's primarily a rye whiskey. So it is 60% rye, 40% bourbon. The ryes are those younger components, so you're getting 3 to 5 year old ryes, some of our grain to glass ryes in there, and then 40% bourbon, which is going to be your older stocks. And for me, it's kind of the best of both worlds. You get that nice spiciness of the rye up front, you know, with that 60%, but that 40% does really help round it out, gives it some length, a little smoothness, which is going to probably be a little more pleasing to your average whiskey consumer. And then we are taking some of that rye and adding some port barrel finish to it as well, playing around with some local port producers and adding that. So you're getting a really fun, complex blend that you can put it in a cocktail. It would be great in a Manhattan, but you know, on its own with a rock, it really just provides a lot of interesting flavors as well.
And why is it called a straight whiskey when you have the bourbon and the rye in there?
So in order to be called a straight whiskey, you have to spend a minimum of 2 years in a charred American oak barrel. And so that puts you into that straight classification. And you have to be, of course, at 51% of whatever your base grain is, your rye or your bourbon.
And you have to store it in those charred barrels.
Correct. You have to store it in those charred barrels for 2 years.
The labels are peculiar. They're eye-catching and inspired by California's conservationist John Muir. And you really seem to be captured by the important work that he did as the father of national parks. It's an homage to him. So it's interesting that you are really tapping into that on your label.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we do have a great story to tell here where we're at in, in Northern California in the Redwood Empire. And I think it allows us to talk about that story. And the labels really help to bring that story to life. I mean, we have these three caricatures on the label that are the names of famous old growth redwood trees throughout the state. And these are massive trees. I mean, you can look them up and the pictures of them online, the Lost Monarch, there's a picture of it online, and there's a guy standing next to it, and it looks like it's a Photoshop job because he's tiny. It's like a little Lego man next to this tree that I think is 26 feet in diameter. So these trees are massive, and they're beautiful, and thanks to people like John Muir, they're still with us today. And so we really want to pay tribute to John Muir, and we have quotes from him on each of our labels, and we are also trying to get back in every way we can. And so we are planting a tree through a program called Trees for the Future. So for every bottle sold or every cocktail made, in addition, a tree is planted. Yeah,
that is fantastic. That's staggering to think about that every bottle sold. So if I go in and drop down $45, a tree is planted. And if someone orders a drink, a cocktail at a bar, also a tree is planted?
That's correct, yeah. So we're working with our on-premise partners to make sure we get all the numbers for that so we can up the Trees for the Future.
That's amazing. That's a great project.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. You know, I'm a California kid. I grew up here by and large. And you know, where we're at now, I live in Sonoma County. We have Armstrong Woods, you know, half an hour from the house, and that's one of my favorite things to do is take people from other states to these old growth forests, and you don't have to say anything. You take people into these stands, and they speak for themselves, and it's they're awe-inspiring.
Exactly. I'm just going to say that. They are awe-inspiring, and it is fun to take tourists and guests there.
Yes, for sure.
That philanthropic effort is commendable. What a respectable thing to do. Not that you need an excuse to drink good whiskey, but now you have one. Buy a bottle of Redwood Empire, or even a glass, and a tree will be planted. To learn more about the Trees program, visit trees.org. By the way, the Lost Monarch tree is 321 and a half feet tall. And as Jeff said, the trunk diameter is just under 26 feet. I read that the Lost Monarch's lowest twigs almost touch the ground, which is very unusual among the largest coast redwoods. If you'd like to see some photos of the Lost Monarch, visit my website, onthewineroad.com. On the labels of their new whiskeys, they feature these quotes from John Muir. "The power of imagination makes us infinite." Also, "In every walk in nature, one receives more than he seeks."
And my favorite, though, "Most people are on the world, not in it."
Yeah, it's a great quote.
Especially these days with cell phones.
For sure.
So as head distiller, you have a team of like four people, and so that this is definitely handcrafted, and you even refer to it as a Sonoma boutique style.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, we're all hands on deck, and throughout every part of the process, we're laying hands on this whiskey. So we're bringing in the grain. We have, 4,000 pounds at a time. In a lot of cases, we're actually adding additional 50-pound bags to that. We're dumping into the tank by hand. And then, you know, we're separating that grain out from the wort after we've extracted all the sugars out of that. And that's, you'll see us in there at the distillery every day raking that grain into bins. Those bins go to a larger bin, and that's shipped to a local pig farmer who uses it for pig feed and has happy pigs. And so we're really trying to keep everything in the county. The whiskeys are all aging here in this beautiful climate. You know, we call it a temperate climate here in Sonoma County, and we now have whiskeys that have hit 4 years old, and we're very excited about what this climate affords our whiskeys. It's not too hot, not too cold. I think we're going to have a little bit longer run out on our aging, but I think we're going to have a more complex product because of that, because it's a little bit more delicate aging process. I mean, we're only half an hour from the coast. We get some great coastal breezes. Really just gives those whiskeys a little bit more, you know, temperate climate to age in.
There's so many complex details, too, like the wine industry. But, for instance, unlike the wine industry, your barrel room, you actually like to heat it up to a point, and then you cool it down, because that's what a majority of those different locations around the country are like, and that works well with whiskey.
That's correct. I mean, so we do have the opportunity in the room where we're aging most of our whiskey to play with temperature, and unlike wine, where you want to keep that temperate, you know, throughout its life cycle in the barrel, we really want to get a little bit of heat on these barrels. That allows for interaction in the wood. Whenever you heat up that whiskey, it's going to expand. It's going to push out into that oak, and it's going to pull all those beautiful flavors and color that we want. Most people don't realize that all of our whiskey is coming off that still clear. So every bottle of whiskey you look at, all of that color is coming from the barrel. That barrel really imparts a lot of the flavors that you're getting in that finished product. So we want to maximize that by playing with that temperature a little bit. Not too much, though. We really don't go much above 90 degrees. And our humidity is relatively stable, so we're not overly humid or too dry. But we want to push into that wood and it really extract those flavors.
And through some of your trials, you've realized that you like the aged barrels a little bit better, about 3 years.
That's correct. I mean, you know, having this winery at our disposal and talking to all these great winemakers we have here, they use, you know, mostly older seasoned oak because it just, the flavors are more delicate, and you're pulling some of those tannins out in the yard and not having the spirit pull them out into your final product. And so we experimented with that early on, and we've gone to primarily older air-dried seasoned oak. And you're looking at 24, 36-month-old seasoned oak because it's softer, and we don't have to fight those tannins. They've already been taken out for us. And while, you know, some of them are good, a lot of them do impart some flavors that are unpleasant, and that would just require a lot more time in barrel that we don't want to wait for.
As I mentioned earlier, Redwood Empire Whiskey is crafted at Purple Wine and Spirits, which Derek Benham founded back in 2001. Jeff has been there since 2011, but in a role that will likely surprise you.
I was hired as a cost accountant. I was you know, helping to figure out how to keep our wine costs in line and keep track of all those things. But, you know, my passion is making stuff. And Derek, fortunately, found that out pretty early on. I was bringing in beers I was making at home. I was bringing in breads I was making at home and kombuchas and stuff like that. So he was able to let me really kind of live my passion. And so that's the evolution I took in, you know, in late 2014. And I moved over from the accounting side to the booze making side.
What a jump.
Yeah, it was definitely a bit of a jump, but one I've never really looked back on, and it's been a very fulfilling and exciting ride.
Especially when you could take your hobby and turn it into your career.
Yes, I get to make, you know, at home I was making, you know, 5-10 gallon batches of beer, and now every day I make 1,500 gallons of beer, and then we, of course, distill that into whiskeys, but it's been a lot of fun.
Since I'm a wine-centric show, I'm sure people are wondering, with your last name being Duckhorn, if you're from the Duckhorn winemaking family in Napa Valley. And you are, but maybe one family removed?
That's correct. I mean, as you can imagine, I've been asked that once or twice before. Yeah. Growing up, my dad is Dan's brother, so a pretty close family connection. And growing up, we were definitely around the winery quite a bit and got to see the success that came out of that winery and how, you know, two people, Dan and Margaret, together with some friends and investors could take something and turn it into what it is today, which is pretty amazing. And how they've really stuck to their roots and stuck to the story of quality and craft. And that's really helped inspire me to go where I'm going.
You guys have a lot of cases going out of here, don't you, here in Grayton? Like, I think I saw 20,000 just in the whiskey.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, we're our capabilities are to make about 20,000 cases of whiskey per year. We hope to someday get to that point beyond on the sales side, but it takes many years for these whiskeys to become ready. And so we lay down about 20,000 cases a year, and those take, you know, on at least 4 years to be mature, and I'm hoping that we can hold back a percentage of that to get to 8-10 years and beyond.
It sounds like you're being very smart about it, and I certainly appreciated getting a chance to taste them. And yeah, you're right on point, man. They are very enjoyable, and I'm sure it's going to be it's going to catch on, especially those eye-catching labels.
Yes, for sure. I mean, as the guy that makes the spirits, it's always nice to have a great marketing team behind you that can produce such beautiful packaging. Our gin is in the same vein, and it makes my job a lot easier because at the end of the day, I love what I do, and I want to do more of it. And so if we can be successful out there selling it, and we have a beautiful package to go with what I believe are beautiful spirits, it's going to be a winning combination.
We should mention Derek's gin real quick, too, because you're making some fabulous gin here. And I'm not a big gin fan, but I enjoyed the tasting of that as well.
Yeah, I think I might have got a new convert on Jeff here with the gin. But we do take a lot of pride in our gin. We spent the better part of a year prototyping it and figuring out what we really wanted to make and trying to make something unique and different in the gin world. And it's 12 botanicals. They're each individually vapor distilled. We have beautiful local fresh Meyer lemons that we bring in 200 pounds at a time, zest by hand, distill fresh. So really delicate flavors that you're getting off this gin. I challenge anybody, even the staunchest non-gin drinker, to taste it. And I think they'll be pleasantly surprised on where gin is has gone and where it is today in the world of spirits.
Yeah, with the lemon flavor, the citrus, and even the peppermint that you pointed out. Some flavors there that you would not expect in gin, and that made it enjoyable for me.
Yes, yeah, it's really fun to play with different flavors on the gin side. I mean, juniper has to be there and be your base, but you have, you know, this open world to play in, and so it was fun for us. And so we've got peppermint, chamomile, we've got some spicier elements, star anise, galangal. And, you know, but they're measured and nothing is overpowering. So it really creates this great flavor profile that mixes in any number of cocktails.
You know, I refer to this town as a hamlet, the hamlet of Grayton. It's like 6 blocks square, I think, if you looked at it. 3 blocks if you're driving through. And there's so much going on in this one little spot.
That's true. I mean, it's as you're driving through, it's a blink and you'll miss it program. But there is a lot going on. We love this town. I mean, we've obviously been here for quite a while in the wine world. And we are in the heart of the Russian River Valley. It's a beautiful locale. We're half an hour from the ocean. We've got redwood forests. And there's just so much to offer in this area for us. And so we do love it.
Thank you so much for showing me around. It was a great afternoon. And looking forward to drinking more of your product in the future.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. I really appreciate you coming up and taking the time, and looking forward to you coming back as we have more products come to market and can taste what the future brings.
You heard us talk about the new branding featuring whimsical hand-drawn images honoring John Muir as part of their new release of rye and bourbon whiskey and their traditional straight whiskey blend. The look of the original Redwood Empire whiskey was classic. It had an aged brown label on a clear bottle, so why change it? To give you a chance to be a fly on the wall, here's Jeff telling me why they were inspired to make the change. At the time, we were in the small tasting and testing space off their fermentation room, and you'll hear some cool jazz playing in the background.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we tried to stay too much in the category. If you look at Kentucky whiskeys, and if you go to like either a bar or a retail space, they all have kind of a look and feel to them. And we just kind of stayed in that because we're like, well, it's got to look like and feel like a whiskey, you know, blah, blah, blah. So you put this on the bar next to the other 50, 100, and it just kind of blends in, which is, we don't really want to blend in. We want to stand out. We're California. We're not Kentucky. We're not Tennessee. You know, we're different. We do things different here. So we really wanted to talk more about that, and we got some great feedback from our distributor partners and, you know, from the retail side. And so that's where we went back to the drawing board and had these done, which I'm really excited about. Like, so we're just getting to market. The feedback
so far,
it's really cool. And we're really tying more into this story of the Redwood Empire, which most people locally here kind of get and understand that this whole area is the Redwood Empire. But you go out of this area and people don't know that, but they know redwood trees. I mean, they know the iconic giant trees and people know John Muir. And so we're really trying to tie more into that story and tell a story.
You can see the three whiskeys with their new artwork, utilizing names of the old growth trees, Lost Monarch, Emerald Giant, and Pipe Dream, on their website, redwoodempirewhiskey.com. And if you click Locate, you can find out where the whiskeys are near you. They also have a link for the Trees for the Future partnership. Such a great idea. I'll take a break, then return with my interview with author and wearer of many hats, Paula Moulton. And now it's time for Wine Uncorked. Today I'm breaking down the numbers from vines to glasses. Now pay attention, you're going to be hearing a lot of numbers. A common acre of vines produces usually between 2 and 4 tons of grapes. 4 tons makes 11 barrels. A barrel is about 740 pounds of grapes and can bottle 24 and a half cases. That seems like a lot of cases for one barrel, doesn't it? A case of wine is about 30 pounds of grapes and can fill 48 glasses. One bottle of wine is 2.5 pounds of grapes and pours 4 to 5 glasses. Unless you like the bigger glasses and you're a bit heavy-handed, then you're talking more like 3 to 4 glasses. And to that I say, cheers. Now, my conversation with Paula Moulton. Not long ago, I sat with her in Sonoma to learn more about this author, viticulturist, winemaker, chef. And what you'll find out is, what she did, you could do as well. Might help to have a green thumb. In her book, Seasons Among the Vines, and subsequent follow-up, she's a self-proclaimed city girl gone country. She writes about her desire to leave San Francisco with her husband and kids and become a farmer and to grow grapevines. But she doesn't really get into what inspired her to do so, so I started with that question. What drove you to move to Glen Ellen and farm a vineyard?
That's a great question. I think there are a few things that sort of fit the answer for that. I think I probably was trying to pick the weirdest thing that I could possibly do at that point in my life. And I also have always had a real attraction to growing things and soil and analyzing the soils. And my dad really taught me that. So I grew up in the suburbs in San Mateo, south of San Francisco, and he cleared a little slot for me and said, okay, grow your vegetable garden. And so that's kind of how I started.
So I guess your husband was on board with this idea, but you had kids. How did they feel about following your dream to live in a small town?
I think they were so young. They were really babies. The three of them were under the age of 6, and so they really didn't have any idea what we were getting into, and neither did I, to be honest. I mean, we started out in Santa Rosa, and then we looked for the property, and we bought the property in Glen Ellen in the early 90s, and that was the 24 acres. And by then, my third child wasn't even born yet. So my two kids will tell you at the time that they were growing up, because we were there for 13 years, they hated it and they wanted to be with their friends and live in the, you know, on a street in Sonoma or whatever, because they went to school in Sonoma. But now in their 20s, they will tell you, oh yeah, it was the greatest thing ever. We had all this land and we could go out in the vineyard and we had, you know, our bicycles and we had, you know, all these things to do, and we felt safe because we had deer fencing and whatever. So now the tables turned a little. I don't know, you'd probably have to ask them the real truth about that.
I'm sure they're honest about enjoying it. I spent some time on farms when I was growing up and I always enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So you have two books out now, Seasons Among the Vines, subtitled Life Lessons from California Wine Country. And the second book is your follow-up with the same title, yet updated to Life Lessons from California Wine Country and Paris. We'll get to the Paris part shortly, but your storytelling is humorous and quite engaging. But what's unique about it is these books, as you say, are an invitation to the reader to learn a thing or two about grape growing and winemaking. You're confident that growing wine grapes is as easy as cultivating weeds, no matter where they live, in the country or the city.
Yeah, I think that was kind of my message to people. And the reason why I wanted to put that message across was because I was a novice myself, and although I went back to school to get a viticulture degree, I knew the technical aspects, but I knew nothing about the practical things, like your well dries up and you can't irrigate, and you know, you have animals eating your fruit, and your winery that you're contracted with is having a fit, and all those things that I went through, which I actually then looked at humorously, instead of, you know, I can't control Mother Nature. So that was kind of my thing. And I decided, you know, how can I share this with the public or my audience and let them know that, you know, there's also a lesson behind, yeah, whether they want to grow grapes in their backyard and make wine at home. It's there's that. But then there's this underlying lesson of, you know what, if you have something that you really want to do and it's out of the box, or you think it's impossible or whatever, it's never too late to try, no matter what age you're at or what level or what career you're in. If you have that undying passion, I just say go for it.
She makes it sound so easy, doesn't she? It is inspiring to hear someone speak that way, with confidence. What will surprise you is the inconceivable tragedy she suffered through. Just 3 weeks before her first book was to be released, her husband was killed in a car accident. It's unthinkable, unimaginable, but as you'll hear, and no doubt it took a while, she survived, and ultimately it did not hold her back.
I think that 10 years later or 13 years later, that passion that I had never left me, although I had to change directions on my roads. And for 5 years, I really didn't look at my book. I didn't have any property left because I spent time really developing and selling it off so I could put my kids through college. And it wasn't something that I ever thought would happen. But I think that it's made my children and the way I view the world totally in a different way. And also, I find it kind of funny that I'm back doing the same thing. No matter what I do, just keep trying to take it away from me, I'm still coming back.
Can't take the country out of the girl.
That's right. Yeah.
How long did you struggle with everything? And then at what point did you finally accept that it was time to move on?
Wow. That's a tough question. I mean, I struggle with it still every day, but I think the first 5 years were the hardest for me because I felt like, wow, okay, I had worked so hard to put all this together, to study viticulture, to grow grapes, to sell the grapes to wineries, to write a book, and now it's gone. All of our land. I still had my children, which was the most important thing to me. So, you know, after 5 years, I started thinking, okay, where am I going to go now? You know, I have to think about this. And so I really waited until my last child went off to college, because obviously I just couldn't take off and jumpstart my career and do something different. And that's when, I don't know, I just got to be in my bonnet about, okay, well, I'm going to leave this country after she goes. She got her acceptance letter to college and I got mine. And I dropped her off in New York and went straight to Paris, where I studied for a year. I felt like I needed to get that passion back. And I wasn't really sure when I did it, like, okay, what am I really doing? And so now I really know why I did it. But I am the type of person that just says, okay, jump and, you know, the net will catch you. So everybody thought I was crazy when I did it. All of my friends were like, I can't believe you're going to leave here and do this insane thing. What are you doing? And it was the best thing that I ever did, because I learned so much more about wine to complement what I had already known here. And to put the two together now, I feel like it has put me in a place that I never would have been in.
Well, it gave you something terribly intense to focus on, too, and put the past behind you for a while.
Yes, and the other thing is that I sometimes believe that some in our brains we're pre-programmed for certain things in our life. And my late husband and I had always said that when our third child went off to college, we would go to Paris, because we had both taken French during college, and we used to laugh about our horrible accents and tease each other. But he was an orthopedic surgeon and was going to work for a hospital in Paris. And I thought I was going to go to school full-time and really get perfectly articulate in French. That was pre-programmed in my mind, and I think that was the sort of precipice to push me over the edge, even though I didn't know I'd be in a wine management program.
Yeah. See, now that makes sense, though, because I was thinking, and you still didn't really answer the question about how did you get from putting the past behind you and deciding to go to Le Cordon Bleu, you know, and but now you've kind of answered that. You already had a desire to go to Paris. Yeah. So you just followed through with that plan, sadly without your husband, but the path was already kind of, it wasn't paved yet, but it was still drawn out. So you had a little bit of that.
And I also felt that all the things that I did while I was in Paris, where I had to work in a winery for a month with two other students, and then I had to work in a restaurant, that was incredible. Going back to work in a restaurant and being the head sommelier was very difficult, and speaking French to the clients. But I always felt that he was with me. And that's really what kept me going, because I really, in my heart, believe that he was with me.
So fortunately, even though you had to get rid of everything that you had the money to put your kids through college, as you mentioned, but also you had saved some for yourself.
Exactly. And that's why I always say, you know, people say, okay, so what's next? Well, you know, I'm lucky I get to write about it and I get to talk about it. So right for this time in my life, I'm happy doing that. I think, as I said earlier today, I think my next goal will be to actually go back to that place and maybe have just a couple of acres and go back to growing my own grapes and making my own wine and having a very, very small boutique winery. And that's kind of my goal.
Yeah. It'd be a nice way to finish, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully not finish, but
after several decades.
Full circle of like, okay, I had that, and then now I've done all this. But really, there's a piece at doing that I want to find again.
So, okay, so we're in Paris now. This is the beginning of your second book. And as you point out, you are, at least temporarily, the country girl who is now a city girl again. So this was a wine management class you were taking at Le Cordon Bleu, which focused on the art of fine gastronomy, the secrets of pairing great food and great wine.
Okay, so how I ended up actually doing this was at the time I told my family that, oh, I found this course in Italy and it's 12 weeks and I really want to go there after I take my third child and drop her off at college. I want to go do this for 12 weeks. And everyone said, oh, that's great. And at the time I was dating someone seriously and he said, oh, yeah, 12 weeks. Okay, I can handle that. And then I just started looking around on the internet and I found that Le Cordon Bleu was doing this 10-month new pilot program. It probably just popped up when I was ready to sign up for Italy, and it was 10 months. So when I threw that out at everyone, they went, what? Okay, that's almost a year.
But what a thorough education you were going to receive.
Yeah, way more, I think, than I could have gotten in Italy. I mean, Italy would have been incredible. I love the Italians, and it was extremely academic in France. I mean, I thought in Paris, oh, you know, I'll have time to go to a few museums and I did not go to one museum the entire time until I graduated and family came over to visit. Then I could go to a museum, because really we worked, you know, in class from 8 to 5 every day, and then sometimes we'd have food and wine pairing, so we'd leave class and come back at 7 and work with the chefs on food and wine pairing and be there till 10. There wasn't, and then study on the weekends, because if you didn't keep up with your studies and you failed, you were going to be kicked out. So
you're still trying to absorb the French at that time.
I am, and I still do have those nightmares of school, like they just keep coming back.
And you talk about in the newer book that you did do a variety of things. You were a cellar rat, and you actually did learn winemaking. So it was quite an overall education.
Yeah, I mean, they actually call it a wine management course, but we started out with viticulture. We studied that for 3 to 4 weeks, and then we all were separated, all the 20 students. We had 20 students from 14 different countries, ages 22 to 60, 10 women, 10 men. And so we all spoke different languages, but we were all, common language was French and a little bit of English. So we were all sent off to various places in France to live with wineries for 1 month and do everything. And so the gamut of what people had, some of the students were living in, you know, Monte Carlo in mansions and driving, had servants and chefs and all this. Wow. And others,
like you,
like me, well, kind of. I actually ended up in a really great situation, but it was purely by accident because I had gone with another girl from Finland, and we were stationed, we were put in a house that my professor took me aside before we left and said, I don't know them personally, and they're 5 men and the mom or wife, and they just bought this. They're from South Africa, and if there's a problem, call me after 8 a.m. in the morning and not, you know, no later than 8 p.m. at night. And so the girl and I arrived on the train in the middle of nowhere. I'm not sure where we were. It was somewhere near Bordeaux area, but I don't even know where we were at this point. And there was no woman. And there were 5 men. And it was not a good situation. So, and they put us right to work in the vineyards picking, and I think it was maybe 10 o'clock at night, and basically said, you will cook, clean, and pick and do everything. And so the next morning at 8:01, I called my professor and I said, get me out of here. We had no cell. I mean, I had my French cell phone that I could use. And he did. We were on the next train to go to his best friend's house in Bergerac, who had 2 students already, 2 girls, one from Turkey and 1 Parisian. So now we got this, now 4 different cultures coming in here. And they were the nicest people. We got to do so much. We got to do everything. We learned everything hands-on, and they made jokes. They took us everywhere with the family, with their friends, but we also worked really, really hard. But they made this joke, you know, we told your professor we wanted 2 strong boys, men. We got 4 girls. You guys are kind of, you know, a little weak on that side. And we did do a few things that were pretty crazy mistakes, but they laughed about it, we laughed about it, and they were incredible to us.
What an exciting opportunity. That's similar to what a lot of young winemakers and cellar workers do. They travel abroad to work in vineyards and wineries all over the world to learn the local winemaking techniques. One of the unique aspects of Paula's books, Seasons Among the Vines, is aside from them being an autobiography, she teaches the reader how to manage vines or a vineyard with detailed instructions at the end of each chapter.
Yeah, so that was a bit of a fight with the publishers, because I had gotten the idea to do that from, oh gosh, I think a few books that had already been out there. I think it was like Water for Chocolate, where it was a memoir type written, and then at the end of the chapter they would give recipes. So I had originally thought I was really going to write a technical book on grape growing. But then I realized, no, you know, I just can't follow those rules. I have to also tell the practical side and the funny side and the silly side. So that's where the whole combination came together. And finally, the publishers accepted that concept. And so that's how it came about.
Well, it's very detailed. Your instructions include composting, farming styles, pest control, even getting to know the bugs in your garden, pruning, irrigation, harvest, and a little bit on how to make wine, too. After finishing the book, I felt like I should receive a certification or take a test and receive a certification.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. That would definitely work.
So I know that you have some sort of, you provide some education, or you're still doing some writing, but what are you doing on a day-to-day basis, and what's the future hold for you?
Well, so right now what I'm really focusing on is trying to educate people about wine, trending with wine, the millennials and, you know, what they're drinking and what their needs are. There's so many people that are so interested in wine, and I think all the positive publicity that wine has gotten in the U.S., things have changed with trending. So really, I'm doing a lot of speaking. I teach classes on how to taste wine, how to buy wine that's in your price range, you know, and that people, the buzz is democratize wine, that really wine is a food. And if we think of it as something to pair with our food and enhance our food, it gives us a totally different reason to really drink wine. And also what's affordable in wine, and how do I buy affordable wine if I can't afford a $50 bottle of wine every night, but I want to have, you know, half a glass at night or whatever to drink with my dinner.
Or two,
or whatever your physician says.
Well, this is truly a book about overcoming challenges and determination and inspiration. And the best part is that you make it a very enjoyable read.
Thank you. And I hope that I teach people not only just about growing grapes and making wine, but really there's a lot of philosophy behind what I'm talking about. And so a lot of people have said, you know, it's really not just about growing grapes and making wine. It's philosophical about life.
And how to deal with life.
Exactly.
The multifaceted Paula Moulton. She continues to be a journalist, an educator, and is available for speaking engagements. I touched base with her this week and discovered she once again had to deal with tragedy, as she was one of many who lost their home due to the October 2017 wildfires in Napa Valley and Sonoma County. But she picked herself back up again and recently finished the draft for her third book, so there's more to come. And she is also growing and managing a Pinot Noir vineyard in Sonoma County's Carneros region. Once her book has been released, I will sit down with her again and get another update. You can learn more about Paula, even ask her a question at paulamoulton.com. That's MOULTON.com. And find her current books, Seasons Among the Vines, Life Lessons from the California Wine Country, and the slightly updated one concerning her time in Paris, at bookstores or online, and go on the roller coaster ride with her. And if you would, join me on Instagram and Twitter at JD Wine Road, on Facebook, and on thewineroad.com. Today's show was researched, written, and produced by me, with music from Kisato Williams, John Russell Bradshaw, and Brad Parsons, Howard Pierce, and Miriam Syed. I'm Jeff Davis. Enjoy your travels on the Wine Road, and I'll talk to you next time.